All right. Welcome to the Identity Implementers Working Group call. Also, welcome to July. Thank you for joining. And for those that are listening to the recording later, thank you also for joining us today. Today, we will go over the working group status updates as usual. And then also, I will be giving a presentation into some research that I've been doing regarding how to auto-generate language wrappers around Rust libraries. And so that's showing a lot of promise. And so I'll do that in the later part of the call. Let's see, Linux antitrust policy. Basically says that we are a community, a community of collaborators, and also in our respective day jobs, sometimes competitors. And so let's bring all the things to the community here that we can share freely, and anything that is proprietary or patent protected or anything like that, let's leave that outside of these calls. And so, yeah, let's have a good discussion. I am going to put in the chat the link to the wiki page here. Feel free to sign up on the wiki page. That helps us know who's attending and be able to reach you should we need to contact you, or for scheduling changes or things like that. Let's see, as far as announcements go, a couple of things. IIW 33 is being held on October 12th through the 14th. So if you want to register for the super early bird time, you can go ahead and do that now. Registration's open. They did comment that this will be the last online virtual conference that they will have, and that they're looking at returning in person, which is scheduled for April of next year. And so that'll be neat. They're planning to, I don't know if they're planning to make that a hybrid conference, but it, I do know that it is intended to be in person finally. Also, the Good Health Pass interoperability blueprint draft is available for public review. I've put the links there. That is a very huge effort to come out of the Trust Over IP organization. And so that is available for everyone to look at and to comment on. Let's see. Any other announcements that I've missed, or is that it? I don't know of any. All right. Let's see. Let's go over the working group reports. Main identity working group. I was out of the office last week. Did anyone happen to attend that wants to share an update? All right. So this, I went and reviewed the notes for that working group, and the, I don't know how you pronounce it, the EIDAS, European Standard for Electronic Digital Identity Wallets is coming. There's a link to that. There was a discussion about self-sovereign identity versus national identity schemes, and trying to figure out where the overlap consensus is. Interoperability is one of the huge things that our whole industry is chasing, but sometimes governments stand up self-contained versions. And so there's a discussion about that and what requirements that places on European digital identity wallets. So I put the presentation notes link as well as the meeting recording there. Did anyone happen to attend the Identity Implementer, or excuse me, that's this call, the Indie Contributors Working Group call? Again, I was also out of there, but or out of the office last week. The big discussion over there right now is getting the next release of the Indie platform, Plenum, Node, the SDK, everything, getting all of that released. There is a status document, so I put the link to the status document. Things that they're looking for, work tickets that need to be completed. They're still looking for some CI/CD help, as well as people to update the code release there. And so all of that is outlined in the status document. Let's see, did anyone happen to attend the Aries A call yesterday? All right, that call, there was a presentation on the data sharing engine and showcasing the OCA platform. I've put the wiki notes there, as well as a white paper to the ACDC effort that Sam Smith has created. He wrote the white paper. And so that's there for your review. So part of that effort is to expand W3C credentials to include provenance chains. And so that is well underway. In the B call, a lot of that was going over PRs and making some progress there. I've listed the various PRs that were discussed. And so those are available for review, comment, editing right now. Oh, I see that Sam has joined us. Would you like to give any other update on the Aries B call yesterday, Sam? I put him on the spot as soon as he joined.
I don't know what you already talked about, but it was...
well, I just barely mentioned that there were some, the listed PRs I've got here on the screen were discussed.
Yes, we did cut off a little early to handle the diff had a not regularly scheduled meeting about presentation exchange that several folks had to go to. So it did end up ending a little early, but it was a really good conversation, particularly about the data representations and also the multiple presentations thing. Figuring out how to present multiple credentials in answer to a single presentation request. So it's really good.
Yeah, thank you. It was a good call. Let's see. Aries Bifold. Did anyone attend that has an update they'd like to share?
I can give a short update. It was a short session, but we mostly discussed updates and also had a short discussion about the shared components, as already in the list over there. That's also the main reason I'm here today, for like creating wrappers around C callable libraries.
Well, thank you for joining. Yeah, this this is, I think, an important area to make sure we can. We only have so many developers that are developing libraries, and if we can share code across platforms and languages, I think that's a net win for everyone. So I'm glad that's of interest in the Bifold group. I've been following what the group is doing. We're not using React, but we're actively following their development creation process, using that as a model for some of the things we do. Thank you for joining today, by the way.
Cool. Glad to be here.
Yeah. Let's see. What's next? The language frameworks seem to have been making evolutionary progress. I haven't noticed any dramatic changes. So I've put the links there for the Aries Shared Components, Framework Go, Ruby, and the like, as well as tools. The URSA group, let's see. Did anyone happen to attend that? I was just reading the notes and hadn't attended. Okay, I know they've been working on an audit, and now they're making progress post audit. On the Trust Over IP Foundation, there was a demo of some of the infographic things that they're creating in their all members meeting here. That was not May, that was June, so that was recent. And so that's kind of what's gone on in the all members meeting. I put a link to some of the slides. The steering committee has been talking about administrative issues, memberships, voting, elections, that kind of thing. But also the big effort that's being discussed is the Good Health Project. And so I know that the final document's been created. It's out for public review. It's pending a vote by the steering committee and the members to be released. And so that should happen very shortly, maybe as early as next week. And then there was some discussions on blogs and what the Trust Over IP will be producing on their blog. And so the notes, the slides there are there as well as a link for the recording. It's what I'm trying to say. Let's see. Various updates. I've started to put in meeting note links for each of the subcommittees for Trust Over IP. I don't attend all of those meetings. I mainly go to the technical stack working group and occasionally some of the others, but I've tried to review the links to be aware of what's going on. And so I put links to their meeting notes there as well. Again, the big effort taking all the attention right now is the Good Health Pass Working Group's blueprint document. And that should be released shortly. Any updates from the DIDCOM working group?
Work proceeds nicely. Right now we're figuring out how to metabolize the draft for VCDH1PU. And yeah, it's going on.
Excellent, thank you. All right. Did anyone happen to attend the interoperability working group from DIF?
I went to that too. It was quite cool. John Jordan spoke with a demo provided by Stephen and talking about the important aspects of interoperability and their experience selling identity and credential solutions, both within the government and within the businesses that it interact with. So that was it was a really good discussion.
So when you say selling, is that financial or user adoption or both?
Kind of like helping guide them to solutions. I don't know whether they're selling it so much as selling them on the technology. But they talked about the different types of things that people expect. Like they expect revocation for example, so when it's not present, like it's an eyebrow raiser. It was really good to sort of get that feedback.
Excellent. Thank you. Let's see, over at the Sovereign Foundation, their technical governance board is meeting as we speak. And so I don't have an update from them. I know the big the big discussions are around the Ubuntu upgrade of the ND platform, upgrading from version 16.04 to 20.04. And I've also put the status document link right there. There's also been a lot of discussion about updating the DID method and also adding carry support to the ND platform. And then the last steward council, again, I was also out last week when all of these meetings apparently happened. So I missed that one, but I put the presentation slides there as well. Since I was out a lot last, the whole week, I don't have too many updates. Is there something that I missed that any of you would like to bring forward? All right, sounds like we about covered it. Here in the US, we are in summer vacation time. And so I know we have lots of vacations going on. And that sometimes affects some of the progress this time of year. Let's see. All right, well, if there's no other questions, then I'll go ahead and get started on the presentation. So let me reshare a couple of things. So let's see if I can find all my stuff. I've got so many windows. So I'm going to start with some PowerPoint slides to kind of set the pace for what's going on here. And then I have code and some stuff I'll show you in the code editors as well. So the goal here was when we first started getting involved in the SSI community, everything seemed to be written in Rust. And then the other big platform that everybody used was Python at the time. And that's kind of waxed and waned over time with other viable languages as well. Our main platform for our company is on iOS. And so Swift was always real important. And so our developers like programming in Swift. And like any other modern language, they have certain things they do and don't do. And those languages are very different than C. And so creating foreign function interfaces to allow us to access Rust libraries was always very viable. It was just hard and it was a little painful. And so we've been looking at different ways to do that, to make that easier on our developers. For those of you on the call that are on the older side like me, then you grew up using C and C++ and things like that. And so foreign function interfaces are complex, but it's not a complete paradigm shift. Whereas developers that are younger that may have grown up on some of these modern non-C type of languages, then this is real different. And so that was the kind of the motivation for getting involved here, was to make things easier on our developers to consume, but then also to leverage all the great work that's done throughout this industry. So what I'm gonna do in this presentation is I'm just gonna kind of walk through super quickly some slides that kind of show what this process is that I'm talking about. And then I'll show you code that I've actually written to allow me to use DIDCOM RS in a Swift application. I just happened to pick DIDCOM RS because that's one of the things we needed. We're also interested in things like ASCAR and verifiable credential libraries and the other shared libraries that are out there. So let's see. So kind of just as a frame of reference, what's going on here is we have all these upper level applications we'll use on various platforms. And then we have this common library, and this wrapper layer is always what's in question. How can we easily access that common Rust library? And it's all very doable. Form function interfaces are very well defined, but they throw some requirements on developers, such as dealing with memory management and memory access models, control models from the underlying library. And so that's stuff that upper level programmers don't really want to think about. What they really would like is a library that matches their platform and looks like everything else they're using. And so there is a project over at Mozilla called Unify. And their purpose is to figure out how to take a Rust library, expose an interface to that library, a public interface, and then to be able to use their tools to automatically generate the language bindings and the Rust scaffolding layer that's necessary to access. So if you've done form function interface programming before, this is intended to build all of that and to go straight from the Rust library to the higher level application. The tools from Mozilla are what I'm basing this on, and I've put the GitHub link right there. I'll make these slides available, and the code I'm going to show, I plan on releasing that as soon as I get a chance to put that up on GitHub. Now, rather than walk through how to do all of this, I've written a series of tutorials that this was basically me getting familiar with the process and trying to figure out the simplest way to show all the steps, both while I'm learning them myself, to our developers internally, and then to anyone else who finds them valuable. So I've created three tutorials that I've released so far. One is a quick FFI intro, and that's all it is. It's just straight how you build a Rust library, expose a C function, what you have to do to call it, what that looks like. And so that is in there as the quick FFI intro. The wrapper intro is where I took very simple Unify, I just did one function in the library, and went through all the steps of how, you know, what you have to do, what you have to create to build that. And then the data types is where I took all the available data types that Unify supported at the time and showed how to use those back and forth between a higher level application. I did it for Swift as well as Python, and then accessed that Rust library. So I won't go into all those details, but I put that out there as a reference. I have fairly extensive documentation describing the process as well as working code. So the Unify process, in a nutshell, here's how it works. You write your custom library and you expose the functions. You build it as normal. And then you, TOML, in the cargo TOML file, you set it up to be a linkable library. And then what you need to do is write a UDL representation. That's kind of a type of interface definition language. I'll show you some examples of that. It's really, really simple. And this is to expose these public functions from the library and allow the Unify tools to grab onto them and to be able to generate all the other layers. So that's really all you have to generate is that file, and it's really small. Now, step three, I put here to generate a scaffolding layer. You have to invoke the command to do that, but it does it automatically. And I'll show you what that code looks like. Then finally, so that's all the FFI layer code. And then on the language specific implementation layer, that's also auto generated. So that will take the FFI type of code that is generated for scaffolding, and it'll make it look like Swift code and feel like native Swift or native Python or native Kotlin. And so once you get that done, you have all that's necessary to import your library into a native application. So just real simple, couple of things from here. This was from that first tutorial that I created. So I just created a simple function that received a Boolean and returned its opposite. My intent was to make that as basic as possible. Then the cargo TOML file, I just had to add the dependencies for Unify. So right now this says 0.8 for a Unify dependency. I'm running this code from today off of 0.10. So I just had to add that there, specify a CDILAB. And then for build dependencies, I specified Unify build, also the same version. And so that's how we got that set up. UDL looks like this, where I create a namespace. Library is whatever name you gave the library. And for better or for worse, that's what I called my library. And then in the UDL fashion, IDL fashion, you specify what that function looks like, its return parameter, its name, its parameters, etc. So from there, then what I did is I would run this command right there, and it would generate a few hundred lines of code that look like this. So if you've built foreign function interfaces before, you'll recognize what all this does. Here's your extern C function that does this and that. And this is all automatically generated. You don't have to touch it, do anything with it. It does all this for you. From there, the next command I run, and I'll show you how to do this. I'll actually do it on the screen live. You call the Unify BinGen interface, tell it to generate the Swift interface based on that UDL file we defined, and then you set the language parameter as Swift. And that one function that I showed, the Boolean test, this is what it outputs as a language platform. So not only did it bring the language or the function over, it changed the case to make it match what Swift likes, so the camel case. It handles all sorts of error checking and things, and calls a series of functions to make this all work. And so it ends up calling down to that library. On the Python side, it's basically the same thing. I run the exact same command, although I specify Python instead of Swift. And then linking in the library, here's how I would, or this is what it generates. And so from a Python perspective, this line 287 specifies the function you'd call, and this is what that does, calling down to the other library. Now on the Mac OS side, I'm more familiar with Swift, so I tend to work there more. What we had to do setting up the whole project, I just created a very simple command line Mac OS Swift app. I had to do a couple of things. The dilib that was created from Rust before, I have to link that in. I have to import the Swift language wrapper that was automatically generated. It generates a bridging header to allow for some of this back and forth translation. And then the code that I wrote, this is it right here for that simple app. So I have a couple of print statements. I have a Boolean value that I set up. I call my bool ink test. It returns the opposite, and then I do an assert, and so everything succeeds. And that's how simple the stuff is. So now my intent here is not to go through that whole process in too much detail, but to talk more about DIDCOM. And so I'm going to move into that and show how I did this for the DIDCOM RS library. Are there any questions up till this point? Hopefully I didn't lose everybody. All right. Well, I think I'll keep going. All right, that was the Python test app. So with DIDCOM RS, basically, it's a really cool library, and it implements DIDCOM v2, and it has a series of public functions that you call to basically, you pass in some information, it creates a DIDCOM packet format in form of a message object for you. You can add and delete, messages, and then you can export it as an encrypted message to transmit to the recipient. And so basically, you kind of have a few main functions, which are create the message, add data to the message, encrypt it, decrypt it, and then retrieve the content. And so what I did is I went through that library and I pulled out some functions that were important and that I could call from Swift to, create, encrypt, decrypt, and then retrieve the message content. So it doesn't do anything with transport layer. This is purely DIDCOM.io. And so this is the UDL file that I created. So I had to actually write this part. And I specified all the functions that I needed. So there's a new, which is a constructor. There's a new receive, which I'll talk about that in a minute, that I had to set up as a constructor because of some UniFi limitations. And then I created a series of getters and setters. So you can get the recipient list, you can set the recipient list. So the to, the from, the body, the message body, you can retrieve it as JSON and some other things as well as routing. And so I went through and pulled those out and I had to write this file. And that should pretty much have been all I needed to do. But there's a couple of things that I needed to do in the code itself. But just at this interface layer, I didn't get down inside whatever's going on to generate the DIDCOM packets. So let's see, these next slides show some things that mainly when I post these slides on the wiki page, I wanted people who look at this later to kind of have something to look at. What I'm going to do now, rather than show you all of this on the PowerPoint, is I'm just going to share my screen and show you what all the code looks like and what I needed to do. So let me switch my sharing just a little bit. And sharing the right screen. Let's see, are you all seeing my desktop?
Yep, with the terminal.
Okay, good. All right, so let me start here. Let me just show what is, so what I did inside DIDCOM RS, there's a message library, and that's the main thing that I wanted to interface with. And so this is that file. I did have to make a few changes. So I'm gonna walk through what the implication of making those changes is. Like I said, I didn't change any logic or any formatting or anything related to the protocol standard. So we have right here the public struct for the message, and that has a JWM header, a DIDCOM header, has a recipient list, and then a message body. And the message body is a string. These others are structures that get imported from other parts of the library. Now the implementation side, what goes on is new actually creates a new message with all the default parameters. So then here, from here on, I had to create those functions that I had specified in that UDL file. And I'd like to kind of talk about why. There is a current limitation in UniFi that you can't return an object from a function. That is being worked on. And it's pretty much here in the current version. I'm using 0.10 and the 0.12 version actually has that. That recently just came out. So I was trying to update all the code last night and decided that I would talk about this for this presentation. And then later today, I'll start making those updates. They're fairly notable. What they do is they enable that returning of functions. They also put in read-write locks around the data to make everything thread safe so that whether you're in the library or in the upper level application, everything's thread safe. So the DIDCOM RS, excuse me, has a function called receive. The idea is that you've received this packet of data in a series of bytes, and you want to decode that, decrypt it, and be able to access the contents. So because of the some limitations in Unify for now, what I did was I had to call the function this way so that I could return a created message structure. And so since you can't do that in version 0.10 as a function call, I had to do that as a constructor because constructors can return the self object. And so what I did is I created this as a constructor. And then in here, I just passed all the data down to their message receive function, and it does all the processing that they did before. The result I get back, again, since we can't return results, because that's a non-self structure type, although that's coming. I basically went through and I decoded that right here. And I said, if it's okay, then I'm just, we'll return the message. Otherwise, if it's not, then I need to return an error code somehow. And because I can't yet return result in this version, basically I just took the message body and I put the error code in there and then I returned that. And so when I'm calling this, I know that this is very super temporary, but I thought I'd point that out. Now, another thing about the way Unify handles things is in Rust, you have the structure type, which contains data in that portion. And then you have the implementation section, which contains all the functions. And because of how things work, an object exposed by Unify can't be a full object. It either is the data portion or it's the function portion. And so what that means is using a returned object from Unify the way we normally would by calling functions on it and retrieving data from it and stuff like that, you can't just access data directly. So the message.body, for example, you can't just read that directly and write to it directly. We have to have a series of getters and setters. And so what I've done here is I've created a series of getters and setters, just basically helper functions for things that that I wanted to retrieve and in the calling application. So here we have get JWM header, I pass it in self and it returns a header. And so what I do in here, instead of the calling application calling self.jwm header, I just clone that and return it. And so I do that for the DIDCOM header. If you see a number 2 at the end of some of these functions, basically they already had a function that that does this, and I had to create a different one. And so I did it with that nomenclature very specifically so that I wouldn't lose, that I would know that I was shadowing one of their functions. But the that also is temporary. As soon as I upgrade to the version that supports returning the result object, then I won't have to do that because that's what their functions did. And so some of these are just you know, housekeeping for working through Unify at this point. And so get recipients or did that same thing. Get to set to was a little bit different. So what's happening is this version is not thread safe, the 0.10, but the 0.12 version that has been released that I need to upgrade to, it is thread safe. And what they do is they put an RW lock around all the data elements. And so that will cascade into all the normal Rust handling for objects that are lock protected. And so that will need to be done in this interface layer. So because this is, I'm trying to make as minimal impacts to the DIDCOM RS library as possible, I've created a series of API functions that if they were designed in from the beginning, then I wouldn't have to do that. I would have just had to create that UDL file that I showed up above. So here, what I do is I take in that mutable self for now. It will be done through the RWLock interface in the next version. But then I add and delete from the DIDCOM header that way. A get from, kind of the same type of thing. And let's see. So I'm doing the same thing with the body because I'm not yet able to return the result. And so that's how that works. So those will all be fixed in the next, when I upgrade to the next version. Here's something that I'd like to comment on for a bit. There's a function in there for you to set the JWM header as encrypted algorithm. And how that's done in a calling application, a Rust application that imports this library, is right here. They load in the create crypto algorithm and specify XC20P. And so the problem is when you're moving through interface layers like this, that's a crate that got imported into the library, and it's not necessarily passed on through the library's interface. And arguably, it probably shouldn't be. And so to make this library a little more self-contained so that I don't have to be aware, I was faced with two choices of what to do with this crypto algorithm. One is I could go to that crate, which I did, and I read through it, and figured out what they did. I can expose that enum through that UDL interface, but that seemed a little risky to me because that crate could change at some point. And propagating things that like that through seemed like a lot of work to me. So what I ended up doing, just for simplicity for this version, is I created a function that basically sets that algorithm. This is what the library normally does as far as when it sets an algorithm, this is the code that it executes. And so what I did is I just made an interface function, had it set the encryption algorithm, and then that's all it does. A better solution might be for DIDCOM RS to create an enum that exposes directly, which are supported crypto algorithms. And then it could list those as an enum. That way I could call a more generic function that says set crypto algorithm. And then I could pass it an entry from that enum of supported algorithms. For this proof of concept, I opted not to do that at this point, although I probably should. But since this is the main algorithm that's used by other test cases, I just created a public function like that. The other thing that was an issue for me was this notion of base 58 key encoding. So in Rust, there's a crate where you can import the base 58 encoding decoding functions. In Swift, there is not. And so in generic Swift, what I was faced with is either writing the algorithm myself, which I could do. It would take some time. It'd take maintenance. A lot of checking and quality assurance that I didn't necessarily want to inherit. So I looked on GitHub. I found a few Base 58 encoder packages for Swift. I didn't know how good they were, whether they fully worked, all the nuances of Base 58 encoding. So again, what I did was I just exposed an unwrap function so that I could take in the key bytes as they're specified in the DIDCOM test cases and duplicated in the DIDCOM RS library test cases so that I could just follow that same format. And that just made life easier so that and on the Swift side, I didn't have to worry about Base 58 encoding at all. I'll show you what I did do here in just a minute. And then the last thing, it's related to that thread safe locking that I talked about before. So the seal function, the encrypt function is really what that is. I actually just cloned self and then operated on it from there to encrypt that. And then I could return that string back. So that's what I did for that. Let me show you what I did do. So looking here at the terminal, I did a couple of things. So the first step that I did was I took that UDL file and I generated the scaffolding. That's about how long it takes. So that's all done. So then I built the library. And it goes through and does that. These warning messages that you're seeing right here, those are because this version of the library is using some non-thread safe routines that in the latest version have been, it's all fixed, it's all thread safe. So that will go away in the next version, but I wanted to point that out if you run this code. The next thing I did was I'm going to create this, the language platform wrapper code in Swift. And so, boom, it's done. Again, to now create it for Kotlin, that's all done now. And to do it for Python, that's now all done. So at this point, what I have is I have a generated Rust library and I have native platform wrapper code for Swift, Kotlin, and Python. There's a C++ version, but I haven't messed with that, so I'm not going to show that. Now, once we jump over to, here's my my Swift application. So like before, I imported the library, the bridging header. This that you're seeing, this is all the generated code. So this is normally, so for DIDCOM RS, it's about 700 lines of code, more or less. And that's code that developers would have had, somebody would have had to written. This is all the FFI language translation code, all these kinds of things that would have had to have been written. And so I avoid writing that by writing that UDL file. And if the original DIDCOM RS had contemplated some of these, you know, locks and unify issues in advance, that's all I would have had to have written was that UDL file. As it was, I made some minor modifications that I showed you. And then when we get to Swift, this is what we're seeing. So having imported that object, I can call message.init, which creates a DIDCOM object. I can then call the set from, and I can pass it that DID key. So this should now really start to look familiar from the DIDCOM test code. So I set from, I set to, I call that set the crypto algorithm. I encoded the phrase hello world as a test, So I add that as the message body. That could obviously be anything and everything you want to put in there. I grab the JSON, and that's where that would be. So I grab the JSON of that plain text message and I print that out. Then I go ahead and encrypt that and decrypt it and pass it on. And so this is where whatever transport layer you're using, whether that's Bluetooth, IP traffic, you know, whatever, that's where that takes place. Then when the receiver receives that, they have their private key that they get to use. They can receive that message and print that out. And so let me just go ahead and run that. So right here, what we're seeing, I'll scroll up a little bit. What we're seeing is I'm just going to call the send receive did key test. So that's the generic one person sends to one person, and we'll see the steps there. And then the next one is showing multiple receivers. And so I'll step over that. So here's what got generated was I started that function. Here's the plain text message that I wanted to send and what that looks like. When it got encrypted, this is what it looks like. So this should all look very, very familiar. And then once that was transmitted and then received, this is what Bob received on his end. And so now, let me kind of scroll back up if I can find all the right wherever it started. Okay, so now we're doing the multi-test. So you can see that the message has two did keys in the to section. You see the ciphertext as needed. And then when Bob received it, Bob can print it out. This is the message, the decrypted version of the message he received. And so we see also down here the hello world on the body. So the second recipient, you see kind of the same thing. And so what I've been able to do was go from a very generic real world Rust library and walk through the process of how to set that up so it's compatible with Unify. Use Unify to generate the language wrappers, and then I just imported those in here. And to me, as a Swift developer, everything that I'm seeing up here where there's actual code really looks and feels like Swift code. I'm not messing with unsafe mutable pointers or anything like that. That stuff happens because it's part of the scaffolding layer, but I, as a developer, don't see it. So, anyway, I'm very optimistic about this method. We may need to slightly retrofit some of the existing libraries to support this, but then once it's supported, the idea is that the library developers can release a new library. This stuff that I showed you here as far as generating scaffolding and language wrappers can be part of the build process. And so this can be automatically done. And so that resulting Rust library can then be available for, you know, mobile and desktop platforms that use these languages. And so that's that. Any questions? I know that's a lot to throw at you, and I'll make the slides available and stuff.
Steve, this is awesome. It strikes me that having the main library developer be at least aware of the Unify efforts could avoid lots of the complications that would require language-specific adaptation of the generated library.
You're totally correct. I actually met with Ivan Tymchenko, who wrote this, or at least one of the main authors of the DidComRS library, and I walked him through this. And so, you know, these are things, part of what Unify requires slightly different than what is canonical Rust. And so, as you mentioned, being aware of that. And so my intent here is to take what I have done, clean it up, make sure it's ready for this, the future version that I'm going to upgrade to, and then create a PR, push that back to the main DIDCOM repo. But yeah, if some of these things, like exposing the algorithm type from an included crate and requiring the application to depend on that, that one, if we're just aware that we want to create our own enum interface of what's supported in the library, we can avoid that one. Some of these others that I created, they'll kind of go away. But the big thing that probably library developers will want to be aware of is resource locking and to make everything thread safe. So yeah. Anything else? Any questions, comments? I'm happy to meet privately with any of you and go over this. I think it's kind of a little bit of a learning curve right now, but once you get over that learning curve and this becomes a little more familiar, the net benefit going forward is that you get native Swift or Kotlin support or Python support from Rust libraries without doing all the work that's required to get there. And that was kind of the motivation. And so it's been something that we've been interested in, something that I'm going to keep doing.
I think this is really cool. I have a few questions, but I don't think, because I think the meeting ended like a minute ago, I don't think I can like shortly introduce them because they require some context.
So I have time right now. Don't know if anyone else does, so we can officially call the meeting done. But I'm happy to meet now, or we can set up another time to meet if you'd like.
Yeah, no, sure, we can meet. That's okay.
I would like to join that extension if that's okay.
Okay.
Awesome.
All right, I will send you both a private note then, and we'll see if we can coordinate and set up another time here in the next day or two. I tried to walk through the whole process, but I'm sure you have specific nuanced questions that are important that I've overlooked just in getting the initial presentation. So let's do that. Thank you all for joining today and for sharing in my presentation.
Thank you.
Thanks.